So, good morning, and welcome to this session's invited talk. Today we have Chris McCowan, who I think we can say with some authority has cast a very large shadow over operating system security and process security over the last 10 years. I'd say it was a positive or negative shadow, but I'll leave that to your discretion. He's been instrumental in things like Point Guard and Stack Guard, which I'm sure almost everybody in the room is imminently aware of. But he's also spearheaded things like the Linux security modules. And today he's really going to talk a little bit about, interestingly, in his unique style, why does security still suck? And with that, I think I'll turn it over to you.
Thank you.
As usual, I'm going to go fast through my slides, so there should be lots of time for discussion at the end, so hold substantive questions till the end. But on the other hand, if you want to shout out a cheap shot, go for it, especially if it's funny. So, security sucks. I love this quote from Richard Clark, that the reason why you have people breaking into your software is because your software sucks. Much more than other aspects of computing. You know, your word processor, well, it has some issues, but it processes the words. You get your work done. The music players, they play your music, and that pretty much works. The web browsers, they browse the web. They have some issues, but they browse the web. But when you buy a security system, you're still not secure. Right, Peter?
Yes.
So, computing is 65 years old. It's ready for Medicaid, but it's not ready for primetime security. Why is that? Why can't we get it right? Because it's hard. For all other kinds of computing, being correct for normal inputs is sufficient. Reliable software does what it's supposed to do. So you test what it's supposed to do. You throw things into the middle of the range. You test the boundary conditions. It seems to work. You call it good and you ship it. But that's not good enough for security, because secure software does what it's supposed to do and nothing else. And it's the funny something else's that gets you. So security is really simple. Only use perfect software. Plan B. So why is correctness more important to security? There are other mission-critical fields like aircraft fly-by-wire and nuclear reactor controllers and things like that that you'd really prefer didn't go wrong. Well, the difference is intelligent adversaries. For the nuclear controller, for the aircraft thing, they only need to guard against probable flaws. The improbable, by definition, is improbable. They don't need to worry about it too much. But an intelligent adversary will look at your code and find the error conditions that you didn't handle, regardless of how improbable they are, and make them probable. And so how unlikely this is to occur in normal operation is irrelevant to the security question. You actually need correctness. That's hard. So correctness matters a lot. Let's throw money at it until the problem goes away. This doesn't happen in practice because, well, developers are lazy. They don't like checking return codes and stuff like that. Languages are unsafe. Java and C# are the first really popular languages that are what you'd call type safe since PL1. 25 years of C. Like, I love C. It's God's own portable macro assembler, but it is not safe, and you should not be writing large, complex apps in it. You should be using type-safe languages, and thankfully now we have some. Customers and magazine product reviewers react to shiny buttons more than quality. You tell the magazine reviewer that this code has been reviewed by 3 independent developers and all error codes are checked and it's in a type-safe language, and they go, yeah, whatever, but the buttons are slow. And you lose out to the other vendor. And so for that reason, managers won't give you the time as a dev to get it right. So the dev wants to ship crappy code. His manager is pushing him to ship crappy code. Surprise! People ship crappy code. Features, quality, ship date. Choose 2. Guess which one people mostly choose. So only really good vendors should be able to ship secure software, right? Well, kind of. Diligence helps, good coding practices, peer review, QA, pen testing, fuzz testing, those will improve your quality. That will make your product much less likely to fall to a security attack. But the benefits are limited because no matter how much you test, you cannot test for what shouldn't happen. The input space is effectively infinite. It's impossible to test at all. Meet Alan Turing. If you're a CS grad, you can read your mail for a minute. But it's my perception that a lot of the security community is what I call self-educated. And you may not have taken the time to go take that course in automata theory. So in 1931, Gödel, a mathematician, came up with this Keen theorem that a mathematical system complex enough to represent itself cannot be both consistent and complete. Consistent means that all theorems are true. When you get through proving it and you get to the bottom, that it's actually true, because there are systems where that isn't true. And complete means that all true statements can be proven. You can't have both. Turing's lame corollary to this was, imagine you built some kind of wonky machine that computed states, whatever a state is, and then you can't write a program that will analyze any other program and its input and decide if it will halt or not. So in mathematical terms, this is crap. Gödel did the work. But with this cute side effect that he invented computers. That had some impact, I hear. So just to fill in the non-computer scientists, this is the proof that it's called diagonalization. If you consider some hypothetical program X that could solve Turing's halting problem, and you ask X to analyze program 1, 2, 3, 4, so forth, enumerate all programs, and it gets to X itself, and you code it so that if it halts, it loops, and if it loops, it halts, and you get a contradiction, and you conclude, since you've got a contradiction from assuming that this program could exist, that it can't exist. The simplest form of this kind of logic is this statement at the bottom: this is a lie. It can't be true and it can't be false. It's just a contradiction. So English qualifies as one of Gödel's systems. And a long time ago, I actually had that on a T-shirt button. So the halting problem applied. If you can't write an analyzer to determine if a program will halt, then you can't decide if a program will or won't write to a given memory location. You might have hardware that halts the program if it ever touches that memory location. You can't decide if it will or won't overflow a buffer. You can't decide if it will or won't grant unintended access. You can't decide if it is or is not secure. So, at a very deep fundamental level, is my widget secure is what's called undecidable. So what about static analyzers? There's people selling stuff that claim to do this. Well, they're using heuristics. You can't analyze an arbitrary program, but you can, in principle, prove that this program is secure. It's not very hard. You go look at the code for Hello World, and, well, if you're rigorous about it, it's secure. But and then you can encode this into a scanner that will, you know, like, knows lots of stuff, and it will come up with answers of, yes, this one's safe, and that one is not safe because I found some problems, or don't know. Or it can be wrong. It can say things like, well, I didn't find any problems. I don't know if it's actually secure or not, but I've run out of things to complain about. So all of these things, while they're useful and valuable, they're not solving Turing's problem. They're not telling you definitively that your thing is secure. What about type-safe languages? Type-safe is the subset of decidability that static analysis that can be decided. In principle, it says, okay, I've proven that whenever this program manipulates data, that they're friends. You're not trying to add an integer to a string. Most type-safe languages have this quaint property that they'll reject programs that are not actually unsafe, that's just the compiler can't prove that they are safe. This makes them unpopular with developers. The logic is correct. They try to compile the program, and the compiler rejects it. After a few days of this, they decide the compiler's broken and go back to coding in C or Perl or something. So we're doomed, right? Not exactly. Security professionals have lifetime employment. What to do? Building secure programs is undecidable. So instead, what we have to do is build belt and suspenders protection for layers of the system to protect against the vulnerabilities that will inevitably appear and reappear. This used to be called secure architecture, and now we call it intrusion prevention. If you grant someone the authority to do something and they do it, don't be surprised. That I consider that outside of the computer security problem. That's a personnel issue. So, meet John Boyd. Even if you are a CS grad, wake up. Boyd was an Air Force fighter pilot. Kind of a maverick. He was, in fact, the original maverick. Founded the Fighter Air Force School that was in the Top Gun movie. And he could kick anybody's butt in air combat. And that's because he actually developed a theory for it. Part of his theory is called the OODA loop. Observe your surroundings. Orient yourself within those surroundings. Decide what to do and act on it. And Boyd said that whoever had the fastest accurate OODA loop will win. You get to your decision and it's correct sooner than the other guy, you'll blow his tail off. His nickname was 40-second Boyd because he could start like in the bad position in an aircraft and within 40 seconds he had you in his sights with an inferior aircraft. Turns out this has relevance to the computer security problem. So what I'm going to do here is use the OODA loop to classify and categorize a somewhat of a survey of intrusion prevention systems. First, when? When is the mediation inserted into the software development life cycle? Earlier is, of course, faster. Boyd likes that. Later is more precise. Boyd likes that, so it's a trade-off. The abstract times I'm referring to are design time, implementation time, and run time. Where is the place in the network architecture that you stick your mediation. And roughly speaking, so closer to the incident is more precise and faster, so that's good. Farther out gives you broader impact, so you can smush the whole network with one firewall. So this decision results to network or host intrusion prevention. And what is what kind of mediation are you applying? Detection is easier because you get to be wrong. Prevention, since you don't get to be wrong, requires you to use more conservative decisions. You don't get to guess. So, walking through this space, when? Design time. Again, I apologize to the scholars in the room, but I'm going to introduce Salzer and Schroeder. This is a paper from 76? 74? Everything important in security, with the exception of public key crypto, is in this paper, and that's only because public key crypto was invented in 79. Everything else that you need to care about in secure design is in this paper. Now, it's expressed in weird terms that involve memory control registers and segments and stuff that you've probably never heard of. So when you're reading the paper, map their discussion of shared memory into discussion of shared file systems on a network, and it'll start to make sense. It's online in several places, yeah. The copy I read was a crappy photocopy, but there's a nice web rendition of it. So there are eight principles that you can extract from this paper. Number one is economy of mechanism. Keep it simple, stupid, because the more complex it is, the more likely it is to be broken. Number two, fail-safe defaults. Whenever someone asks you a, should I let this guy in question, if you don't know, say no. That's a much more secure answer. Complete mediation. You need to design such that all possible means of access to an object are mediated. There isn't a way around it, i.e., if you build a fence halfway around your house, your dog will run away. Open design. The design should not be secret, and in particular, the security of the design should not depend on its secrecy. And that's easy to extend to the modern parlance of open source. Number five is separation of privilege. If human decisions are part of the input, which Peter was talking about with insider misuse, It's nice if more than one human is required to make the operation go through. Depending on the scale of the operation, that can be a hassle, so judicious use of separation of privilege. Least privilege. This is my favorite. Whenever you do something, you want to do it with the least privilege necessary to get that job done, because then, when something goes sideways, you get the least damage. Least common mechanism. They advocate minimizing the amount of mechanism that's common across components so that a bug here doesn't end up over there. I think that one's kind of sketchy. And eight, this one is one that is often skipped, is psychological acceptability, that if the users don't like it, the users will turn it off. And that showed up in the panel yesterday on human-computer interaction, ease of use, and security. It's an emerging field. I've been telling students that for years, but now it's starting to catch on. So these principles have held up well over time, some more than others. Least privilege is a spectacular success. I don't know anybody who disagrees with it. It's really, really effective. Please use it. Least common mechanism, not so much. A better strategy seems to be to use common mechanism, but to carefully audit it. Because if you use least common mechanism, that kind of undermines your economy of mechanism issue. You end up with redundant code. Unfortunately, these principles also turn out to be expensive. You know, diligence, care, reading your code. And quite often, it's easier to just ship crap. That's a very good economic model. So, past design time, looking at implementation time, static analysis. This is that thing I said you couldn't do. Syntax checkers, they basically are fancy grep. They know the stringish patterns for bad code, and they look through your code, and they bitch about it. Oh, look, you called getS. Stop that. It's a very useful first cut. It's easier than thinking. Semantic checkers, David Wagner's work, for instance, the analyzer starts to understand what the program is doing and can detect things like, hey, you don't have enough checks in here to actually bound this buffer, so you're going to get screwed. Type checking is the decidable part of static analysis, where the type checking the compiler is effectively proving that whenever this variable interacts with that variable with the plus and the greater than and the equals and the assignment, that they're all of the correct data type. Taint analysis is another interesting form of static analysis where you can track that this is user input. The program hasn't filtered it at all, and go down through the APIs and see how far it gets before someone checks whether this is valid input. That's a really useful thing that a static analyzer can do. Better static languages. There are safer language variants. These are research projects, Cyclone and C-Cured. They attempted to take a subset of the C language, the part that they could actually secure, and then add back some stuff to make it usable. And then there's just better languages, Java and C#, previously known as ML or PL1, where instead of an exploitable buffer overflow, you get type error, program rejected, at compile time. And if you want, what you wanted was a reliable product on delivery, that's great. If what you wanted was rapid prototyping, that's annoying. So there's dynamic techniques. Patrick mentioned my work on StackGuard in the late 90s. Which was a compiler technique to insert a runtime check in the program to detect one particular kind of buffer overflow. Format Guard was another of my works that detected the new vulnerability class of printf format string attacks. There are dynamically safe languages like Python and Ruby, previously known as Smalltalk, that instead of an exploitable buffer overflow, you get uncaught exception, program halted. That's not reliable. Their program is dead, but at least it didn't give up control to the attacker. But in the meantime, it lets you ship the broken code, and people who need to deliver stuff on internet time like that. So These are good choices for languages to use as long as you're not writing aircraft controllers, nuclear reactors, or authentication systems. What about C++? No. It looks safer, but it isn't, because it still supports pointer arithmetic and other nasty features. So what C++ delivers is the safety of C and the performance of Smalltalk. In my humble opinion, no program should ever be written in C++. There is no appropriate use for it. If it's a high-level desktop thing and you want to do lots of glorious OOPI stuff, then use C# or Java or something for your high-level OOPiness. And if what you wanted to do was write kernel drivers, then you should be using C and understand that you are handling a chainsaw. There's no point. There's no use for C++. There's no excuse for this. Runtime library and kernel enhancements. LibSafe was some very interesting work where it was basically a variant of glibc that checked the parameters for the big seven string functions of stir copy and so forth. And it would look at the arguments and go, that target argument, it looks an awful lot like the call stack of the caller. I think this is a buffer overflow attack and I'm not going to do it. OpenWall Linux, long ago, introduced this keen concept of having a non-executable stack segment that's enforced by the kernel. Non-executable data pages was a basic concept for most processors, but not the x86. So this made it hard to do on the x86, and OpenWall used a cute trick to get it done. And this means that the classic stack smashing attack where you overflow the buffer, change the pointer, and point at the malicious code that you just uploaded in the form of a string doesn't work because the string you uploaded doesn't get to execute. But it's bypassable because you can, instead of pointing at shell code that you uploaded, you can point at the code that's in glibc that's linked to every program in creation that says exec shell anyway. PAX is a high-security Linux project out of somewhere that they won't really tell you that provides non-executable heaps as well. This is a really good trick on x86 because the problem is that on sensible processors, you have separate bits per page that say readable, writable, and executable. And on x86, you only get readable and writable. And if you want it to be executable, you make it readable. PAX achieves this with fun with TLBs, where they mess with the virtual memory translation buffer cache thingy and invalidate all of your readable pages. And when you try to execute them, they TLB fault, software handles it and puts it back. And that works. It's really cute, but it has performance issues. And so finally, the NX feature came along where AMD and Intel got it right, and now you actually can have pages that are readable but non-executable. Yay. And off in a different direction is another of my Usenix papers, RaceGuard, was a kernel hack that detected that the file that I'm opening is different from the file that I checked on a minute ago. That means that someone's racing me, so I'm not going to open it. All of these things are, those are all badness detectors. They don't follow that rule of default deny. They say, yeah, do whatever you want unless it's on the bad list. Where, we'll just discuss briefly, host or network. So host OS features, this is host intrusion prevention. It's up close, it's right on top of the incident when it happens, and so you can get a very precise view of what went on and so precisely determine whether it was good or bad. And it's fast. You're right on top of it. You can prevent it right there. So Boyd would like this. Network mitigation, firewalls and such, it's farther out. The firewall's over here. The target of the attack is over there. It's really hard to figure out whether this traffic going through is malicious or not because traffic is getting mighty complicated. But it does give you a more global perspective, so you can do better correlation to decide whether someone's doing a sneaky seven-wave attack on you. And it gives you more global impact, that one firewall can cover 100 machines, whereas host mitigation, you have to put it on all 100 machines. So IT managers like this. This is why firewalls sell like hotcakes and host intrusion prevention is an emerging market. What can we do when we have a problem? Detection or prevention. Intrusion detection is what you call it when your detector is too lame to prevent the attack. It might be too slow to prevent the attack. By the time you figured out that it was an attack, it's already happened. And if you put your thing in line, then you slow your whole machine down. Okay, I have to ask mother every time I get to do it. Or it could be too inaccurate. If you're using heuristic guesses of, this looks funny. Blocking access based on this looks funny will make users very unhappy. Prevention, automatic blocking, requires that whatever detection method you're using is fast and accurate. And that limits you on the techniques you can use for detection. So both of them actually have value. The detector is very good for trying to detect things that are suspicious, but you're not sure. So they each has value depending on what threat you're trying to achieve. Default allow or default deny. All the previous things that I discussed, they were badness detectors, and they allow everything else. That's called misuse prevention. It's also called default allow. Quite often, but not always, it's signature-driven, where not only is it a badness detector for bad things happening to my machine, but it's actually a script of this is the attack that we've heard of going around. Antivirus and network IDS tend to use the signature technique a lot. But what happens when the attackers invent a new bad thing? Well, if you're an antivirus vendor, it's called profit because they sell you a subscription to their AV service forever. There's lots of money to be made in incomplete security solutions. Anomaly prevention is the opposite, where you say, we're blocking everything, and only the things that are on the list are allowed to happen. You specify what's allowed, block all else. You can think of this as policy-driven security. We're going to write a policy of what's allowed, and everything else can just shove off. Which to use? Misuse prevention is much easier to live with, and anomaly prevention is much more secure. So what did you need? Delving in a bit, statistical anomaly detection, I believe, started with Stephanie Forrest's Sense of Self paper in 1996. Oh, yeah, of course, Peter's going to tell me how it was done in the 50s. 83.
Yeah.
Okay. All right. So the idea is that you come up with some statistics about what good stuff looks like and bad stuff looks like, and when the stuff that's going on doesn't meet your statistical requirements, then you freak out and say, that's probably bad because it doesn't meet my statistics. And the result of this is that if you train it hard enough, you can get it to pretty much distinguish between good stuff and bad stuff. The problem is mimicry attacks, where the attacker crafts an attack that smells like good stuff. Specifically going against Forrest's Sense of Self process, which was looking at n-grams of system calls, you know, like 5 or 10 system calls in a row in a rolling window, it built up large statistics of these are the n-grams that my application always performs, and when it does something else, then it's being weird. So the attacker can build attacks that use the n-grams that are within that statistical boundary by inserting no-op system calls that do stuff that the attacker doesn't care about, such as opening non-existent files or files that don't matter. So that your attack looks just like a real attack. And the improvement on statistical intrusion prevention is to start considering more extraneous matters, like where was it called from or what were the parameters to the system call. And you can increase the sensitivity of your statistical analyzer at the expense of making it more complicated and slower and harder to train and bigger. And this turns into an arms race where the mimickers keep getting more sophisticated and the stats people get more sophisticated and so on. So a different notion is access controls, where never mind how you're behaving or what you're doing, we're going to specify who gets to access what or not. And the issues are how to specify who or what or how on how to abstract all of this, because just specifying controls on every single bit is tedious. Network access controls, that's traditionally firewalls. And a firewall, let's look at it for a second in this classification scheme. It's based on the source and destination IP address, port number, and protocol, i.e. the stuff up to layer 4. The rules are absolute. Stuff gets through or it doesn't. There's no fuzziness. And it's default deny. The firewall blocks everything except for the ports that you open. So you can think of a firewall as like a giant pegboard with 64,000 windows, and you can pop open port 80 and port 443 and maybe port 25 and leave all the others closed. So this really is a Salzer and Schroeder-friendly machine. Network intrusion detection and prevention is the opposite in every way. It's based on the packet content and context of, oh, I've seen this before, or this sequence matches with that sequence, and I'm starting to remember things. And the rules might be heuristic, that stuff gets through if it smells okay. Quite often they're signature-based, where the IDS machine, like Snort, has a big database of these are bad attacks and don't let them through. And then it does weird things, trying to polymorphize them so that you can detect variations on the attack or fragmentations on the attack, and this leads to your arms race again. And it's default allow. So network intrusion detection is a crappy firewall? Well, yes. but it's a flaky firewall that's working at a higher layer where the traditional firewalls just can't. Up to layer 4, traffic is very, very regular. Your mail, it always comes on port 25, and your web traffic is always on port 80 and 443. And it, well, not always, but close enough to always that that's a decent rule. You can live with it. Network traffic above layer 4 is very irregular because people keep inventing new applications. And if the firewall was default deny at that layer, then you'd have to be messing with it every day as somebody invented a new application, and presently it would be so porous there wouldn't be any point. So you can build a default deny network intrusion detector, but you really wouldn't like it. So why would I want a flaky firewall? Signature-based network intrusion detectors can only block known vulnerabilities. So I say that NIDES is a kludge that you use when you can't patch your bugs. Because if you know about it and you can patch it, why are you depending on this thing to block it when you should just have secure code?
Isn't that NIPS, not NIDS?
What? Sorry?
Shouldn't that be NIPS if you're blocking, not NIDS?
True. The NIDS doesn't even defend you.
Yeah, okay.
So why you would want this is because quite often you can't patch. The machine is on a mission-critical production run, and you can't shut it down. The vendor hasn't issued a patch yet. Your QA department or the vendor's QA department isn't done QAing it yet, or they did QA it and it sucks. So for whatever reason that's not your fault, the vulnerability is out there and you can't patch yet. So having something that you can stick in front of it is a value. But it's important to understand that NIDES and NIPS, these are kludges that you use to mitigate weaknesses in your patching strategy. If you have a good patching strategy, you don't need this. But very few of us have a really good patching strategy, so you probably do need this. Host access controls. This is OS features to let you specify who can access what on your local machine. Discretionary access control, again, I apologize to the scholars, he who creates the data can grant it to anyone else. And mandatory access control is he who owns the system decides who can access what. Mandatory access control thus allows the system manager to try and strive for the principle of least privilege. Lampson's access control matrix is an interesting abstraction over this, where you enumerate every object and every subject being users or processes or entities that do stuff to stuff, put it in a giant matrix, and then in each cell you decide what they can do, read, write, execute, and populate it with access modes. So it's an interesting abstraction, but it's not practically useful. What it really is good for is an abstract understanding of what every other access control system is doing. The matrix is huge, so errors in specification would crop up all over the place. This is another element out of the Salzer and Schroeder paper. Two ways to look at more abstracted access control systems is access control lists versus capability systems. And that an access control list attaches the security attributes of who can do stuff to the object. So you could think of that as being going to the file layer and going, oh, okay, I'm going to make a list of all of the people along this row who can access me. And a capability system is the other way. You attach the security attributes to the subjects, processes, and say, what can I access? And it's called a capability because when I get the right to access it, I have the capability to access it. Classic Unix mode bits, the Chmod stuff, user group world, that's a really crude ACL system where the lists are of length 1, and you can kind of cope with it because it lets you have group access. So in considering access control lists versus capabilities, it's hard to compute the least privilege for a process based on access control lists. Remember that principle of least privilege? We want each process to be confined to only have the right to do what it needs to do and nothing else. But on a Unix machine with thousands and thousands of world-readable files, that's not least privilege. So you need to scan every object in the system to determine what this process can access. So that's crazy. You can't do that. To achieve an approximation for least privilege, you need a capability system that will confine the process to only do what it's supposed to do. A first-class capability system, Shapiro's Arrow system and many systems that came before it, they make capabilities into a first-class programming object that programs can share around. So I have the capability to read this file. I can hand it to my friend Peter. An ambient capability system in one in which I have the capability to read this file not because I have this thing in my hand, but because the OS said so. And I don't get to hand it to Peter. I can say, Peter, look at this, and if Peter also has the capability, then he gets to read it, and otherwise he doesn't. Ambient is better for confining legacy programs because most programs don't know anything about this stuff. They're programmed to work with just the Unix access control list concepts. They don't know anything about capabilities. Virgil Gligger has this great quote that capability systems are the system of the future and always will be. Is that Butler? Great. So if you wait for all of the applications to be rewritten for your favorite security system, you'll be waiting a very long time. But ambient capability systems can work without touching the software. So least privilege for programs. In the 1980s, most systems were timeshare. You had 400 people logged into the mainframe, and the primary problem of your access control system was keeping the accounting people, the marketing people, and the research people from messing with each other too much, but still allow them to share. And the problem with users is that they are big, hairy objects that with opinions. A system that it can do all that is very complicated. In the 21st century, most computers are one user, because it's your workstation, or zero user, because it's the mail server. We don't really have timeshare systems anymore. Well, unless you're at a university, in which case they do, I'm really not sure why. If you want to securify a one user or a zero user machine, user-oriented access control is really not interesting anymore. What you want is least privilege for programs, so that the web server, it serves web pages, and the mail server, it serves mail spools, and they don't mess with each other. Yeah?
Isn't the servers just time-sharing machines?
Sorry?
Aren't the servers just time-sharing machines? Different users connect up to them, get their files, their mail.
Yeah, but you don't log into the machine for... Yes, exactly. You don't have general purpose computing access to the machine. You say, mail server, give me mail.
And it's only one user. When you run a pass, it runs as www.data, right?
Yeah, but maybe one loads
something. So like I said, cheap shots during the talk, extensive discussion at the end. Danger, product pimping. In the Linux space, I live in Linux space, there are two contenders for how to do capability-based access control, SE Linux and AppArmor. SE Linux uses a concept from the 80s, a very fine concept called type enforcement, where you assign users, programs, processes, what it's subjects, to domains. It's an abstract blob. And you assign files to types. You put labels on them that say, this one's green and this one's blue. And then you write a policy that says that this domain can access green and blue files, but not yellow ones. AppArmor is much more explicitly Unix. You have path names, where you say, this path name, user bin Apache, can access these files, /var/www/htdocs*. And whenever it runs, it gets to access those files and nothing else. So the label scheme, half of your policy is in the labeling scheme, where you have to go and basically write a policy that says these are the labels that should be stuck on all the files. That enables strong analyzability for your security posture, but it forces you to specify the label scheme ahead of time. And relabeling is very expensive, because generally a relabeling also causes a change in the rest of your security policy, and this goes around a few times. It's very static. It forces you to get things correct ahead of time, or it doesn't work. AppArmor, on the other hand, provides for late binding. All your policy is in the policy. You can read it, which enables you to trade away the analyzability for flexibility in the face of changes in your real-world systems. There's also an issue of ambiguity. A path name, a single path name, is not the only name that that file could have. You can have multiple aliases that point to it. But a given path name does lead to a single file. Labels, on the other hand, a file can only have a single label, but access to the blue label can lead to all of the files that have the blue sticker on it. So it really is, what kind of ambiguity did you want? And this is serious pimping. The left is the SE Linux policy for Woo FTP, and the right is the AppArmor policy. And when you blow them up, the SE Linux policy is a programming language, and the AppArmor policy is absolute path names with some stars in them and RWX over here. So no new jargon. People who know how to use Chmod and Bash can already read AppArmor policies. So summary. Security is harder than it looks. Making a system secure is very hard, and in fact, is it secure is undecidable. Therefore, securing a system is a continuing process, not a condition. The old guys always say that, and this is why. You need to supply belt and suspenders to defend your system against the inevitable latent vulnerabilities, and we call this intrusion prevention. Intrusion prevention comes in when, where, and what, where when is when in the design cycle, where is whether you're going to do it on the network or on the host, and what is, are you going to detect or prevent, are you going to use a whitelist or a blacklist, and are you going to use statistical methods, or are you going to use actual access control? I draw you a picture, but that's two nested 3D cubes. The Art of InfoWar by John Boyd is to use the OODA loop, where the winner is the one with the tightest, fastest, accurate OODA loop. Your intrusion prevention choices, you want to get closer to the site of intrusion to work better, because it gives you the tight, precise OODA loop. But if you're farther out, you have a bigger hammer. So it depends on how much precision and speed you can afford. As always, whether or not you get what you pay for, you definitely pay for what you get. And while I'm standing up here, more pimping for the Network and Distributed System Security Conference. where me and Bill Arbaugh are the program chairs for next year. It's a pragmatic security conference, very much like USENIX security. Papers due September 10th. The actual conference is end of February in lovely San Diego. All right, now you can ask the substantive questions. Yeah, I believe that pain is it. In the 80s, your bank had a network, but you didn't have access to it. In the 21st century, your bank is on the web, and those black hat guys are going to provide the incentive to get it done. The rising tide of threat is what causes this stuff to happen. And to be fair, not enough. Business decisions are balancing costs and benefits, and I believe that business guys are actually fairly good at it, that business probably has an appropriate amount of security applied for their current level of threat, and as the threat goes up, they'll apply more technology. And telling them they're stupid because they're not secure enough, they're actually right. They're secure enough for their purpose.
You just based on a hindsight view, they don't know what the cost is.
Well, they'll find out. they're taking a risk. Business is about calculated risk, and some people lose and other people win, and that's business. Rick.
Rick Farrow. Actually, I think part of the answer, I have a question really, but I want to make a comment on what Patrick brought up, is that one of the reasons we don't see more people dealing with this is not so much a level of pain, is that people have given up. They're just going, oh, my God, we have all this legacy crap around here. Everyone's going to use Windows and Office, and so we're shit. You know, there's nothing we can do. We're just going to live with this. But that's the depression view, although I see too much of it. Now, to really the question, during your presentation, you got around to talking about SE Linux and AppArmor, and I'll agree SE Linux is a real difficult thing to deal with. AppArmor is a lot cleaner. I like that. But I'd like to argue that it's trying to deal with the old problem. Okay, the old problem is that we're going to protect files as our, you know, the files are going to be the objects we're going to protect. I made the comment, I sort of shouted out, oh, an app, a server is essentially a one-user application. Even though lots of people use it, it runs in the context of a single user. Would you agree?
Well, you could be referring to the user who's saying, give me Bob's mail, or you could be referring to the HTTPDD user. The latter is an
attempt. For your security decisions within AppArmor, are you saying, I am going to run in the context of Bob, or I'm going to run in the context of the IMAP server? Generally, it runs as, you know, IMAP
Neither.
Server. Neither.
AppArmor doesn't care what your UID is, and it.
Oh,
is
right. It's going to use the path name. Okay.
Yeah, and it's oblivious to whether it's Bob or Carol who asked for email. That's the mail server's job.
Okay. Well, see, that's where I think the picture sort of starts to break down, because if you're saying, okay, I am going to use AppArmor, and part of what I want AppArmor to do is prevent Bob from reading Sue's email, then it really can't do that.
No, it can't.
Another issue is, suppose we have a client system, and so somebody's running, they have their web browser, and they never, you know, they just put their machine to sleep. They use it all the time. So their web browser has been up for weeks. It, in its memory, contains loads of interesting passwords, among other things. And since it's all running in the context of the user, any exploit that user accidentally runs has access to all their memory, all their passwords, everything they've done. So, and again, something like AppArmor cannot protect them from this. Remember, we're talking files versus memory.
You are correct that it can't solve those problems. To solve those problems with AppArmor or SE Linux or anything else, you'd have to do something adaptive to the way the user is using the web browser and shut it down or somehow partition its memory into regions or zones or virtualization. There's lots of work in this space, but the transparent legacy solutions can't fix that problem.
Yeah, I agree. You know, I'd like to talk more offline.
Sure.
Thanks.
Jeremy.
Well, I had a whole list of questions, and all I can say is, well, not all I can say, but what I'm going to start with is ditto to everything Rick is saying, because that's really the essence of the problem that we are facing in this decade as opposed to last decade. I think you've done a great job of explaining what the problem was we needed to solve last decade, but that's not the real problem today. The problem that I run into is with our products, people write Java code that runs within our server, and it can do whatever it can do within the context of that application. And unless we virtualize the virtualized machine and create our own operating system and so on, and then run an IDS within it, we can have all these techniques that you're talking about, and they aren't going to do any good at all.
Well, so AppArmor actually does have a feature that can help you with that, but I was trying to limit the product pimping.
Well, except that it's all running within a single JVM.
And we can fix that.
Well, yes, if you're willing to re-architect things. But the point I'm trying to ask is, what is being done, to make this a question instead of a speech, what is being done to actually address the real problem, which, as Rick says, is the server is the multi-user system. Is there anything generic being done as opposed to things that are specific to Apache or specific to this J2EE server or that?
I see two classes of things being done. One is better programming languages. Life gets better when you write your web apps in Ruby than in PHP. And the other is forms of isolation, so that this web app is running in a different security context than that one. And that happens in many layers. The virtual server, OpenVZ, Virtuoso people are doing it. The Zen people are doing it. The VMware people are doing it. AppArmor does it at a very fine-grained level in that without re-architecting your Java apps, we can isolate one Java application from another. We can't do it for Mozilla because Mozilla's not written that way. But hey, Pete.
Hi, Pete Laskoka from NSA. Since you were bringing up SE Linux versus AppArmor, I wanted to point out that you've done a pretty careful job to paint their differences in terms of path name configuration versus full policy configuration, but really the differences are quite more fundamental. Where SE Linux tries to control everything that can happen on the system and protect the system from things that run on it, AppArmor is really about protecting a application and what it can do, or not protecting the application from the rest of the system, but just protecting the rest of the system and what that application can do to it. And so there's no real choice of saying, hey, other things on the system can affect what the security of that application is. And so if you're comfortable with the idea that nothing else in the system is going to interfere with that application, then AppArmor might be the right choice. But you have to make that decision consciously to say, hey, there's nothing on the system that's going to be bad.
So AppArmor fairly clearly treats the threat model as being the network interface and not the rest of the machine.
So is that...
I also want to disagree with the characterization that these are black and white. I believe that there are shades of gray. It's incorrect to say that SE Linux mediates everything. If you roll way back to the Multics covert channel attack where a high process could leak data to a low process by messing around with the memory paging rates, and you could actually type text across that channel, right?
It's not controlling everything, but it's trying to be comprehensive in what it does control.
SE Linux is controlling a lot.
As a policy administrator to say, hey, I have fine-grained control over everything that runs on the system, and if I have not granted it, it's not okay.
Yeah.
So if there's a piece of malicious code that's running in a domain that is unprotected, then it's more or less the same as AppArmor. But at the same time, you can say, hey, I have a domain, and I'm not going to grant any access to this. A piece of unmalicious code that I haven't analyzed, I have the ability to say as an administrator, it's protected, and things that are running in protected domains are not touched. And so if you're comfortable that inserting code through some path into your system is going to be prevented in some other way, then just protecting what a particular application does is a secure thing to do.
Yep. It's absolutely true that SE Linux lets you achieve a higher degree of security than AppArmor does at a higher cost.
So I would request respectfully that in painting those differences that you be more honest about what this difference is. It's not a question of path names versus
I believe it
bigger
is.
Pulse. No, it's not.
No,
it's a question of what is the security target that you're looking for. Do you want to have a comprehensive security solution, or do you want to protect your system from
application? No, that's a matter of degree. That SE Linux mediates more than AppArmor does is the current state, and there's no architectural reason why it can't be changed.
I didn't quite follow that.
The one difference that you've pointed out is that SE Linux mediates more things than AppArmor does. Well, great, we can mediate more things, too. We can play this game all day. And the other difference is, what are the things?
No, it's not
and
a question
really
of mediating
fundamental.
More things. It's a question of mediating everything on the system. And so that's the difference.
You mean the strict policy.
So you can mediate more things by saying, I can write more policy for all applications. But that's not what you're really advocating. You're basically saying...
If you have a default policy which says for everything else, you don't have these privileges or whatever, you get what you're talking about in SE Linux, right? If you have that in AppArmor, you get an equivalent SE Linux.
Attempt to bring the audience up to speed, SE Linux has two policy sets, the strict policy set and the targeted policy set. The targeted policy set looks a lot like AppArmor, where you write an SE Linux policy for Apache and another one for SendMail. And I believe, Pete, correct me if I'm wrong, that you're referring to the strict policy in which you define everything.
I was trying to take away from the decision of any particular distribution's choices and how they were going to use the mechanisms. There's quite a bit of flexibility in SE Linux, and the ability to specify a policy in any number of ways is there. What Red Hat has done in the targeted policy that you refer to is try to say, hey, I'm going to concentrate on network-facing services. And in that case, it's fairly similar to what AppArmor is doing for certain targeted things. You still have a little bit extra because there is some additional controls of everything else that's happening on the system, because there has to be policy, even in the targeted policy, to control things that are running. If you choose to, any other distribution or any other user can customize the policy to control specifically what's running on the system. And you have that power to do that. And you really don't have that with AppArmor. You have to go through every application on the system and write every application policy for it. And at that point, you can say, which is more complicated, to write some general rules about the whole system or to write some policy about everything that's running on the system?
Yep, that's correct.
AppArmor doesn't yet have a default policy feature. Like this, and you're comparing the two, be a little bit more honest about what the differences really are, okay?
Sure, there's differences. Yes, sir.
Yeah, this is really quick. Your web page says there will be something up July 1st.
I'll have to chat with Bill about that.
If you Google for NDSS call for papers, you get the call for papers. Oh,
and there's a pile of call for papers sheets on the junk mail desk out by registration. Peter.
To some extent, the difference needs to be characterized in respect to Paul Cargier's 1987 paper, which was limiting the effects of discretionary access problems with respect to Trojan horses. And what he proposed was basically some sort of access control, this kind of mechanism, where you specify exactly who can do what to whom within whatever process or domain or context that you're dealing with. And I guess my question is, to what extent has SE Linux and your stuff really followed that through to the extent that it could be followed? It seems to me you've done a part of it. But when I made my comment about worrying about insider misuse as well as intrusions, the Cargier stuff recognizes that Trojan horses are effectively insiders when they're operating. And so you really want to worry about what happens from the point of view of the the quasi-insider that is executing as if it were you, whether it's in your zero-user system or your one-user system or in a time-sharing environment.
So
the question is really, to what extent do SE Linux and your stuff respect what Carger was trying to achieve in 87?
Going way out on a limb, because I haven't read Carger's, say, 87 paper, I suggest that what they do is somewhat. If you Trojan the Apache web server, an AppArmor or an SE Linux policy would confine it to only do web server things, but would not be able to prevent it from serving up bogus web pages that, you know, a phishing site might want to offer or something like that. I'm not aware of how access control at a granular level of per process could help you with Trojan software beyond the level of scoping damage. Did I get that right? Okay. Adam?
So trying to tie this back to Boyd a little bit, one of the things that he talked about was the value of implicit controls and the value of speed in going through your loops. And I think maybe there's an interesting distinction to be looked at in what AppArmor does versus what SE Linux does in terms of the speed and your ability to operationalize quickly for new threats, new systems that you need to deploy, and the operational changes to those systems that have to be made.
That's very interesting. Pete will get upset if I start pimping harder on my product.
Oh.
But that's an interesting point. In the back.
When you mentioned Multics, it got me thinking about CIOS. Whatever CA is calling it now, eTrust or whatnot. Do you see that as being comparable to SE Linux? Where do you see that in the spectrum or other things that I haven't thought of?
I see CIOS, to the extent that I understand it, as being in this space. But I definitely don't understand it well enough to really speak specifically to whether it's more like SE Linux or AppArmor or some other system.
Hi. I just wanted to make a comment about the earlier slide you had comparing that talked about access control lists and capabilities.
Sure.
And brought up this other type of capability system that you called an ambient capability system. So if I understand correctly, you're saying an ambient capability system is one in which the authorities are associated not with the objects, but they're also not specified when you actually exercise them.
They're associated with the subjects, not the objects.
Right.
And the subject has no control over the association. It's a mandatory policy that says that this subject has these capabilities when we feel like it.
Okay. And when you want to exercise a particular capability, like you say, I want to open this file, it sounds to me like you don't actually present the capability. You
No.
just try it.
Yes.
And God or whoever checks your list and decides whether you're
that
okay.
That is correct.
Okay. So one of the primary advantages of using a capability-based model over an access control list model is that in an access control list model, you have a list of user IDs, right, or a list of accounts or
a list of subjects in some form
that you have to manage independently of the subjects themselves because the objects have to refer to the subjects in some fashion.
Mm-hmm.
And switching to the model you described has that advantage, right, because you no longer have to maintain this list. However, the other advantage of capabilities is that when you exercise an authority, you specify which authority you're exercising and for what purpose, so that you can't be confused into exercising that for the wrong purpose. So this is the confused deputy problem that we're talking about. And it would seem to me that in an ambient capability system, you are still vulnerable to confused deputy attacks.
That the subject could be tricked into exercising a capability for a wrong purpose.
That's right.
If we assume that the subject is foolable, it's got a defect of some kind, yes?
It's not necessarily that it has a defect, but it doesn't have the information it needs to know whether that capability is being used for the right purpose.
Okay.
Right, so if, for instance, let's say I want to park my car at this hotel and I'd like them to park my car for me, but I don't want them to get into the trunk, I can hand them, right, the valet key, which allows them to drive the car but not to open the trunk.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm specifying exactly the capability I want them to exercise when they're parking the car. Whereas if I don't specify which capability I want them to exercise, then I don't know which purpose it's going to be used for, so it might end up getting used for the wrong purpose.
When you handed them the key, you handed them an explicit capability.
Exactly. Right, and that's not what's happening in an ambient capability system.
Right. So was the claim that the first-class capability system defends against misused capabilities and ambient don't? Or
that's right. That's right. Because when I make the request, I'm specifying, please use this authority to carry out my request.
Uh-huh.
As opposed to, please use any authority you happen to have available, you don't know which one it's going to be, to carry out my request.
But just working the valet analogy a little bit, you handed the valet your valet key and said, park the car, and he took it for a joyride to Vegas while you were having dinner.
Sure. I mean, that's what I've handed over with that key, right? But my intention in handing him the valet key instead of the normal key is I don't want him to get into the trunk.
Uh-huh. So that's least privilege, not confused capabilities. You handed him a more limited capability.
I did. But the ability for me to enforce the policy I want by handing him that limited capability, right, requires
right.
that I hand it to him for a particular purpose.
Right. So the difference here is that in a first-class capability system, you as an application can mess around with the capabilities that guy over there gets access to because you're explicitly handing them to him. In an ambient capability system, that's all mandatory. The administrator who writes the policy, the AppArmor policy, the SE Linux policy, they write a policy that says, when you talk to him, he gets this, regardless of what you think.
Okay, so if feel free to cut this off if we're taking too much time here, but if you were to implement the valet key in that system, how would I hand over the authority to drive my car without opening the trunk?
You wouldn't. In an ambient capability system, you don't have the right to hand over authorities. You suggest to the valet that he drive your car, and the ambient system will provide him with a key if it feels like it.
Okay.
is your point that you as the user in the ambient system don't know whether or not the valet now has access to the trunk as well? Is that point?
Yes. It's that if you want your programs to cooperate, you need to be able to delegate authority in a controlled fashion.
No, you don't.
All right.
First class capability systems do have advantages, and quite powerful ones, and the main disadvantage is their lack of existence.
please read about Eros.
Yeah, I'm familiar with Eros. One of the properties of Eros is that it's dead. Sir.
So several people have asked questions sort of commenting on the movement of security policy from kernels into application servers. I was wondering if you could comment sort of more generally on sort of how can existing techniques cope with this and what else should we be doing going forward to secure application-level security policies such as email and databases and all that sort of stuff.
You mean how can an application...
How do you protect Alice from reading Bob's email when their authentication is being done in the mail program? And what general techniques can be, applied to more than one specific case-by-case basis?
I suggest that if you're trying to leverage ambient capability systems, which seem to be what's emerging for Linux in both SE Linux and Red Hat, and in Sun, and in Windows, that you get better security if you use discrete programs that cooperate than if you try and write a monolith. So big shout out to PostFix, the mail server, because it's got 25 odd programs and you can write tiny policies for each one that keep them out of each other's hair and make them do the right thing. That still doesn't address your Alice and Bob question. To do that, then you would have to have the application explicitly talking to the security system to say, I'm switching from Alice to Bob now, and I, be- I know AppArmor supports that, but then someone would have to rewrite their application to use it. I don't know if SE Linux supports that kind of facility, and Pete, you can jump up and comment if you want to. Yeah, that's the main thing that happens when you let an application manipulate the access control system is you are trusting the application itself. And that's the problem in the first place. If you could trust the application, then you wouldn't mind whether it mediates Alice and Bob.
I think this notion that you have only 0 or 1 users on a system is just, if you'll excuse me, dead wrong.
Okay.
I think every system has tons and tons of users. There's these system administrators. There's each source of the program essentially is a different, each writer of a program is essentially a different user on the system. In fact, in some ways, more of a user than the actual users that have physical access to the system. So the number of people involved in these systems is enormous, even in systems which are personal computers that have just one, and certainly in servers where you just have lots and lots of possible users.
I believe we're actually in violent agreement.
I'm just disagreeing with your slides.
I agree exactly that when you have on a personal computer that has hundreds of programs on it, what Mozilla does to my desktop is the opinions of the Mozilla developers and not me. And so having a targeted policy so that you can say Mozilla gets to do this is, in the terms you're using, user access control for the users who wrote the program. I call it program-based access control. Red Hat calls it targeted policy. But it's doing what you said. The difference is that between program access control and user access control is that program access control is very limiting. Mozilla only gets to do Mozilla things. It doesn't get to read mail. It doesn't have a shell. It doesn't do all. Users would be very annoyed if they had to live in that policy. And a user-oriented access control policy has to be a great deal more flexible and thus more complicated.
Anil Somayaji Carlton, hey. So as some of you may know, I'm a big anomaly detection type person, and the reason why I believe in anomaly detection is because I'm lazy. I don't want to sit there and tell my computer exactly how everything is supposed to behave. I don't even necessarily know how every program is supposed to behave. Unlike your past work and with StackGuard and other things, those you just compiled your program and it worked. Here you're advocating a very knowledge-intensive system, as are the SE Linux folks. Who's going to encode the knowledge about all the programs, and how much work is it?
All of the systems you mentioned have a learning mode.
All of them have a learning mode, but it's a question of who has to sit there and actually tell the system exactly what's going on. I mean, there's the, here, do this, do this, do this, versus go learn something.
Right. And taking from a comment you made over lunch yesterday, statistical anomaly detectors do unsupervised learning. You show it the behavior and it goes, yep, that. AppArmor does somewhat supervised learning where you show it the behavior and it presents you with a log file and asks you questions about it. And Pete, again, I'm going to let you tell me I'm wrong, but I believe it is a more supervised learning mode where you've got, is it called audit to learn? Right. So you can do a learning mode.
Right.
Yeehaw.
but so who does that? The supervised learning. Who's the supervisor? Is it the developer, the sysadmin, user, some combination thereof?
The tool doesn't care. As a matter
who's
of
the intended audience,
right? That varies. We would like the developer to do the supervised learning and ship the policy with the application. We have not yet achieved world domination, so that doesn't happen very often. In the case of SUSE Linux and in the case of Red Hat, the distro writes the policy that they ship with their applications. And quite often the end user who is running some program from those Oracle people you might have heard of that didn't ship with the distro, then they end up writing policy of their very own for the apps that they've collected up in their data center. So it could be the dev, it could be the distro vendor, or it could be a system administrator of a data center. In principle, it could be a desktop end user, but realistically, I think that people in this room could cope with that, but general purpose users is unlikely.
Mm-hmm. Okay. The reason why I ask that, because it seems that in order to have true least privilege, you really want to have the uses of these programs customized to a particular environment, because otherwise, you know, programs are huge nowadays. They have all kinds of capabilities that shouldn't be allowed that in most environments. And so you'd really want to write a policy that said, well, you know, that whole, you know, sure, I'm running Mozilla in my environment, you know, the old Mozilla, but in our environment, we don't use the mail application. We just use a web browser. Could I somehow limit that? Or could I restrict which modules Apache is allowed to use? And if you have to manually do that, that seems like a lot of work.
Yes, it is.
Okay. Thank you.
I just wanted to respond to this, to continue the discussion on this. I don't know that maybe we shouldn't worry too much about the policy writing task if these tools have value. So I'd like to use virus scanners as an analogy. Look at all the work that the virus scanning companies do. They have teams of people to keep their virus signatures up to date. And look at, and let's compare at how much of a kludge the end result is. If these tools have value, if that business model works, why can't we, I don't see any fundamental reason why something similar couldn't be used for these kinds of tools as well.
Are you suggesting that I should turn AppArmor into a blacklist policy model and then sell subscriptions for stuff that blocks malware?
Absolutely not. I am suggesting that there's a heavy burden to writing the policy for virus scanners, and yet somehow businesses have sprung up to shoulder that burden. To the same extent, to say that there is a burden of writing policies for SE Linux or AppArmor seems like we shouldn't necessarily give up on the technology, because businesses may well spring up to shoulder that burden as well.
Ah, yeah. So yes, there is a burden for policy writing. I'm trying all of the approaches to get people to write policy, and I'm sure Pete is too. Everybody, please help us write policy.
A brief respite from the current debate. It seems like a really good idea to have one single authoritative authority mandating access control for the entire system. There are numerous applications, and each application has its own level of abstraction as to what constitutes a capability. I think the most obvious example is a database system, where you have a complete, total different abstraction on top of the file system, which is a totally different set of data with totally different access controls. It would seem to me to make sense, then, to try and coordinate those different access models among each other. And I understand that application developers, especially of applications that were written before anything like AppArmor or SE Linux came about, couldn't do this. But have you thought much about the interaction of application developers with your system, which it seems like the privileges that are being set there is the basic operating system paradigm: read, write, execute, file-based, perhaps process-based, perhaps memory space-based, but none of the higher-level abstractions of this application may want, like extent or like a container of some kind or table. So I was wondering if you thought about that and what the thoughts might be as to how those systems might interact.
I've thought about it a great deal. The overriding design philosophy of AppArmor is transparency. that it should be very easy to create policy for an application. And so if I can't figure out how to more or less automatically generate the policy, then I don't put in the access control. SE Linux has a different design goal and a different design philosophy, and so they likely did something different. We are working on adding more access control, mediating more factors and different abstractions when we can get it right.
So if I were going to write an application that wanted to use the overall, at runtime, wanted to use this overall, you know, governor to say, you have this capability and that capability, you can read this person's email or you can look at this table, I didn't want to do that myself. I wanted to delegate that to the overall system authority because it has information that I don't. Could I then interact with either one of these systems, SE Linux or AppArmor or anything else, through, say, a library or through system calls?
Yes, both systems have a library call. AppArmor calls it ChangeHat. I don't recall what SE Linux calls it, that says change your security context from the current one to something over there. The AppArmor system was inspired by ModPerl. So, yeah, I'm running a web server, but now I'm interpreting some clown's crappy CPAN Perl code, and I want to apply a different policy to that than I do to Apache. So you call ChangeHat and change to a sub-hat, or a sub-policy made just for that Perl script, and you can have as many of those as you want.
Are the policies the same? Like, do you still only have file access level policies and things like that set up? Okay, so you can't define new policies like this person has access to this set of data as I define it in my application, and maybe another application somewhere that might coordinate might want to use a similar policy saying people have access to that set of data.
Certainly don't have a way to programmatically construct new abstractions.
Yeah.
That would be extremely hard. What I am working on is adding new abstractions so that you can write a policy that says something more nuanced than file access.
So if someone else wanted to define something outside that, and then the two applications just happen to know about that policy, they could share that abstraction.
No, I'm aiming at transparent access control, so the applications, again, wouldn't know about it. You would write a policy that says you get this, you get that. And the main exception to that would be the UID stuff so that you could keep Alice out of Bob's mail. Okay. There you need an explicit API to say, I'm working on Alice's mail now, thanks. Please confine me appropriately. There's a degree of weird trust going on there because the application itself voluntarily confined itself to Alice's mail. And if you can hijack the application, then what stops you from messing with Bob's mail?
Okay. Cool.
I just wanted to follow up a little bit about the policy complexity and just to say that for a system like SE Linux and to some extent a system like AppArmor, you're attempting to control things that are happening on an already very complex system. And when you were running things on that system before there was any kind of mandatory access control structure in it, that complexity was hidden because you didn't need to see it. And people saying that they want secure systems, you need to understand that that complexity can be used to defeat the security that you might want to have. And so when it comes time to writing policy and deciding what to control, you have to make an explicit decision to expose that complexity. And without exposing it, you really can't get that security. And so when it comes to writing policy, it's just a fact of life that if you want to do it, you're going to have to control it. And so whether it's SE Linux or AppArmor, to the extent that it controls everything it does, we have to go through the problem of writing that security policy. And whether that's done by a distribution or some third-party company that's doing it, and there are companies that are springing up that are taking on that burden to understand customer spaces and writing policy for that. So that hopefully, as this technology matures, it won't fall down on the end user to write that policy. It would be nice, like Crispin said, to say, hey, let the application writer supply that policy, but that's not likely to happen tomorrow, but it might happen in the future. Things like package distribution systems are trying to address how would I lay down policy with that, and whether that's for AppArmor or for SE Linux, the problems are going to be the same. It's just something that as mandatory access controls become more mature and more adopted by the mainstream, these problems will be solved. They're all solvable problems.
We managed to write the code. We can figure out how to write the policy for it. And Pete's correct that letting the end user do it all is not scalable because okay, the amount of code I'm running on this Linux box is enormous. And even if writing policy was only 1% as difficult as writing the code, that's still too much for me to write policy for Mozilla and Thunderbird and Game and X and Apache and OpenOffice. So we're going to have to get a distributed share and enjoy model for policies or it won't fly.
Hi. So if I understand correctly, so in SELinux or AppArmor, the policies are very targeted towards applications. And I would like to know if you're familiar with systems that are more targeted towards information flows. So I'm thinking of, for example, Asbestos.
Where get up again. AppArmor is very targeted towards applications and not towards information flows. The SE Linux targeted policy is similarly targeted towards applications, but SE Linux itself is not. It does have information flow properties that I'm not qualified to discuss, and Pete, you can talk about it if you'd like.
Today, that kind of information flow policy. And so the underlying structures in SELinux are flexible enough that would allow you to do that. Whether you're going to be able to go to Red Hat or anybody else right now and get a distribution that's enforcing that policy is a little bit different. There are companies that you can go buy special custom things from, but I'm not going to recommend any of this one.
As you said, so your level of taint changes dynamically depending on the information you're accessing? Is that correct?
It's still a mandatory policy over the whole system where you're saying that, hey, this global property about information flow is going to be enforced, and you have to express that in the policy. And that may reflect in terms of this application, or at least this application with this type of label needs to be in a particular domain in order to allow information to flow in a particular way. So if that, in an MLS sense, a top secret process, regardless of what application it is, will not be able to flow information down to a secret process.
See. So I guess my question was, do you think that's an interesting direction to go towards?
It's interesting to people who want information flow policies, and the dominant policy that people want information flow on is MLS.
Well, it doesn't have to be MLS. It could be just application-level users. So, for example, your mail server, once it's touched, data that has to do with Alice changes to it's kind of tainted with Alice and cannot go and touch Bob's data anymore.
So if you're going to ask the sociological question, are people interested in information flow in that way, I argue that no, they're not. They're barely interested in application security. I don't lose deals to SE Linux. I lose deals to people who can't be bothered to do anything at all. And information flow is even harder than either of these systems. Thanks.